All right, welcome to it. The round table. For this, the 28th of July, we're doing it for Burke Financial, offering homeowners personalized mortgage solutions for approvals in as little as an hour. And fast funding, visit burkefinancial.ca, brokerage number license 13111. Joining us, former journalist, communications advisor to the Premier, founder of KPW Communications, Carmen Wong is with us. Hello, Carmen.
Hey, everyone.
And Newstalk 1010 political commentator, friend of the show as well, Trevor Mayo. Hello, Trev.
Howdy, howdy.
Welcome to you both.
It's off with a real simple question. Should we rename Dundas after former Mayor Rob Ford? Carmen?
Okay, so the whole point of renaming Dundas Street is because of the divisive nature of Henry Dundas's past. So I don't think renaming it Rob Ford solves that issue. I think, you know, he did do a lot for public service. There are a lot of residents in Etobicoke and constituents who will say that he did a lot for them. But for all that, he definitely did some things that may have offended people. And I remember covering this as a journalist. It's not the first time it's been suggested that something be named after Rob Ford in the city. There was Centennial Stadium that was voted down by council. But then there was also a public push to name a street in Etobicoke after Rob Ford. And at that point, the Ford family requested that his name be removed from consideration. So I don't know where the family stands on this presently, but if the family wasn't even there at that point, I think that's already the end of the discussion.
So Trevor, I got to say, I don't think any of us think that Dundas Street will be renamed after Rob Ford. But I guess the broader question is, should we even be looking at politicians, given the history of some of the challenges we're having now, some of the divisiveness that Carmen has talked about, should we just say politicians shouldn't have their names on things like streets?
Maybe. I mean, quite possibly. Politicians do make policies that affect different populations in positive and negative ways. And those are viewed under different lenses as we move on. And so maybe these are people that their impacts will have a negative connotation and feeling for populations in years and decades to come. And so maybe it is off. But like, let's also recognize this. What's firing up here with the Ford thing is like, this petition has 300 names. Right. Like, so like we're jumping in on this more than there actually is this big swell of people. Like, I had more people nominate me as social butterfly in my high school yearbook than what's actually coming through. Like, I could whip up more people to nominate, you know, I mean, my best friend Tyler to get a name after him if I really fired up a Facebook campaign. So like, it's also us leaning into all these like controversial things about like, people want this name. Well, like that, there's 300 people. Let's be real about how many people are actually calling for Dundas to actually be renamed in Ford's honor. But Dev, to your point, like, maybe it's about reframing and saying it's not people, because our viewpoints on their positions, their policies and their impacts do evolve over time. And we're not gonna be renaming our streets every 40, 50 years.
So let's talk about a story we just had the opportunity to talk to the mayor about. It has to do with a City of Toronto purchase for a home that had on it a 250-year-old tree. Now, what the city had agreed to is a price of $780,000 back in 2019. The owner of that house did not expect, hey, pandemic surge pricing. So here we are today, where he's looking for $900,000, a jump of $120,000. So Carmen, a couple of things at play for me here. Number one, you made a deal. You should probably stick with it. And number two, key to the story, I think, is that one of his concerns was that he and his family would be homeless, except the rub on that one is he doesn't live in this house. He actually rents it to other people, and he lives in a separate house.
I see this a couple of different ways. So look, the homeowner did sign a contract, but you said that was in December 2019. It was contingent on the community raising a certain amount of money, and that would go take him to the next year, December 2020. So now we're a full year later. That homeowner has been waiting since 2019. He's definitely had cost incurred to have that property. If the time frame has gone beyond that, if he should be released or be allowed to renegotiate. Also, I think $100,000 more is a drop in the bucket for the city, who could then end up spending even more money fighting this property owner in court or resources. So those are the ways I see it.
Yeah, and Trevor, we all know how much the city hates being in court.
So, you mean, he signed an agreement. I get that. It was contingent on the community raising $400,000 to offset the cost, which they did. And so that was a condition on this deal. It wasn't saying that that was going to happen in 1 month. It wasn't going to say it was going to happen. It was the timeline that funds were happening. This owner also is dismissive of things that actually would negatively impact the value of the house in terms of resale, in terms of like potential deep root issues to the foundation and things like that. So like, I think it is a bit of a push. The thing that actually rubbed me the most out of this was the cry of saying that they're going to be homeless. This individual owns two homes, as you mentioned, Jay. Yeah. I will never own a home in my entire life in the city of Toronto because it's so unaffordable. I have a really hard time when someone's crying that they think they're going to be homeless because they own two homes and yet they're going to be hard done by. I'm not knocking their success. I'm not knocking what they own. That to me was the thing being like, I can't get on board with you needing to break a contract because you think you're going to be homeless, because that's just so ridiculous to me. So you have an agreement, stick to it.
So, Carmen, I don't know if you've had a chance to see this picture, but for everyone, including Carmen and Trevor, it is on our Instagram page. And it's a photo that has been used by Reuters and actually other media outlets of a Chinese gold medal weightlifter. And it's come under criticism by the Chinese embassy in Sri Lanka because they say it depicts Western athletes in a far more positive light compared to Chinese athletes. And I quote, among all the photos of the game, Reuters has chosen this one, which only shows how ugly they are. Don't put politics and ideologies above sports. Are they right here, or is this the kind of photos that we should expect to see from our Olympics? Trevor?
I think the word ugly was a bit intense for them to just define as ugly, because the picture is actually showing the individual in a feat of strength. So it's actually still an impressive picture. And so when I first heard this, I was like, okay, like maybe this is the case. In the top of my mind, I'm like, I've seen divers be in a tight spins and those ridiculous faces that they make. I've seen other people in terms of different moments of them in boxing and their face all contorted. And I'm like, well, like, is it just that? At the moment, but then I actually started looking through when this came through a number of the photos that we're using to showcase Olympic athletes in their championship moment, and a lot of it is them on the podium, it's them celebrating after their win, it's them of and actually like quite complimentary lights. It's not in the feat of strength always, like those are important images to capture. So I don't know, but I think there might be a little bit of merit to some negative bias here. Maybe it's unconscious that actually is being used by some of the editorial rooms and using this Reuters image because it's not the same type of image that's used to show the success and the win when showcasing other people in their medal moments.
Carmen, do you agree with Trevor and I guess the embassy in saying that this is a bias against Chinese athletes that doesn't exist with Western athletes?
No, I don't completely agree with Trevor or the embassy. I think I've seen other pictures that look like that. I think weightlifting is a strenuous sport. I think those capture the moment that are happening during the Olympics. I also saw when I looked at this quickly when we were going to be talking about this, is the China Daily, which is a government sanctioned publication by the Chinese government, had a similar photo of this athlete. So I think, why would they run the same photo if they think there's anti-Chinese bias?
I think we can agree too that the games are going really well. Another day, another scandal. This is interesting. Let's talk about whether or not this would work in Toronto. Bike riders in London, Ontario, now have their own lanes as well as their own traffic signals. As city crews upgrade roads, they'll be adding traffic lights that govern bike lanes to help cyclists make it through busy intersections safely. Now, to bring it to Toronto, Trevor, we had an issue recently where a law that wasn't being enforced, that was going through a stop sign in a certain area of the city because of complaints, police started to did a pop-up traffic blitz, and I think they gave out 63 or 64 tickets. Should we have traffic signals for cyclists that are more problematic areas in the city?
Absolutely. If you have a dedicated lane, I think it's a great idea. They have them in Mississauga. Like if people are driving through Mississauga, Aramills Parkway, Burnham Thorpe, like huge significant arteries in the city, they have these on dedicated bike lanes, which are often separate from the traffic. They have a dedicated bike signal that sometimes is separate in terms of its color and its direction than the actual automobile one or the pedestrian one. And it's safe. It works quite well. And it wasn't flipping the table by cyclists. It was something that worked out quite well. I ride my bike in the city. I also drive in the city a lot. And I think as both a cyclist and as a driver, I think this is something that would keep me safe as a cyclist and also would reduce some of the tension as a driver as well. And so I think it's on the dedicated bike lanes and on some of these bigger intersections, I think it would be helpful.
Carmen, your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think Toronto's made a decision to invest in bike infrastructure throughout the city and make it easier for people to use their bikes. I would just say that sometimes when you have too much going on at an intersection, it can get a little confusing. But I mean, if there's a significant impact to make the road safer or, you know, the flow of traffic better, I think it's a good thing.
So there's a new study out that says Gen Xers, so those born from the mid-1960s to the early 1980s, are not as likely to want to be trained or to be open to training in the workplace. According to the study, 63% of job seekers aged 45 and older have been unemployed for more than a year versus only 1 in 3 of workers aged 18 to 24 in the same boat. Do you see this? Do you see this in your workplace, Carmen, where older workers are less likely to want to be trained or retrained in the workplace?
Well, I could just speak for myself. Like, I'm a Gen Xer, and I think I worked in a newsroom for a long time, and I think definitely, like, younger reporters were using things that I wasn't as capable in. They were, you know, learning the TikTok. I don't even think I had Facebook for a long time. I maybe used Twitter for reporting, but they were doing that. But also, they didn't have what I have, which is more developed skills and more life experience. So I think to be a successful business or to have a successful corporate culture, you probably have to have a good mix of all types of people, whether it's by age, gender, or ethnicity.
Trevor, I found this a bit interesting because quite often millennials get a bad rap for their workplace efforts. But do you think that this is true of Gen Xers?
Yes, I do. But I would position it a slightly different way. Is like it also went on to talk about how they're like sitting on there's a larger percentage like sitting underemployed and things like that. I think millennials are often underemployed, underpaid in their work. And from I used to work as a recruiter and looking at people at later in their career and in terms of they actually value and understand their financial worth a little bit more. Whereas millennials roll in and will seize up things in terms of being underemployed. So I think there's a dynamic there in terms of people actually recognizing their worth and actually pushing for it and waiting for it. And that plays into a little bit in terms of people of different generations being taken advantage of or underemployed. So I see it a bit, but I don't think it's just necessarily someone like in their like 40s and 50s being stubborn about, I'm not going to learn a new writing program. I don't think it's that simplistic because maybe there is. I mean, Carl and HR maybe having an issue with that, but like, I don't think that is commonplace for everyone. I think it's a little bit more complicated in terms of people late in their career actually understand a little bit more about where they are and what they need.
I was actually the first person at News Talk 1010 to learn parkour.
Believe
it or not.
Sure you were.
I was. Carmen, Trevor, great discussion. We thank you both. Have a great night.
Take care.
Deb, I'll let you practice tonight, and then tomorrow you and I will parkour together.
I was going to say, and on that note.
We are back tomorrow afternoon at 2. My thanks to Donnie. Our thanks to the Mikes. Your CTV Evening News is coming up next. Have a wonderful night.